Accession number 24193, reel 16.
Mr. Tao, reel 16. We're talking about the patrol of the night of the 29th, 30th of May, 1952, and you were in a sticky situation, phone base 2.
Yes, we were. I felt we were being hemmed in, and I had that feeling that we might be cut off. So I withdrew our own little group, the three of us that were left, back into our firm base 2, of which they only had half left because they, following orders, had taken on the casualties down to the firm base. Then things were, and the mortars, the enemy mortars started up, and shots were beginning really to whiz around us. And so I asked our Bren gunner on the left to fire, and I remember he saying, "What at? Can't see anything." And I think I yelled, "It doesn't matter, you bloody fool, just spray the area, because we're going to withdraw." And anyway, he fired away. I don't think he hit anything, but he indicated that we were not going to be easily crowded out. We then gradually leapfrogged our way back down to Henderson, and regrouped there, and by then it was about 5 in the morning. It was dawn was coming up. The covering fire was still going on, but we then called that off. I remember before it was just getting dusk, I remained up the feature ahead of the base of Henson's base with one other and the radio operator, and just looking and waiting, and there was nothing, but the firing was coming, following us down the hill. So I thought we should go back and just recapitulate where we all were and what we were doing. Reported this by radio to the battle adjutant and our company commander, who then ordered us to withdraw. But clearly we were missing some. We got back to battalion headquarters, had a look at ourselves, our casualties, and there were a number. And then we said, well, you know, there are people still out there, and what are we going to do? We had a brief discussion. And I said, well, I was the only person, I mean, I was the person who knew where they were. I think we should go out again, like now, with a lot of covering fire from just about everybody, and see, I will go as close as I can to see if I can find any of the missing. It was just getting, dawn was breaking. So I think we turned round. I took Ginger Nutter again, probably one or two others with me, and interestingly, Trevor Hart, the medical officer, decided, because they're going to, if there were casualties coming back, they would be in need of urgent medical attention. So he agreed. He volunteered to come forward with a medical staff and stretcher bearers and the rest of medical paraphernalia that might be needed. So he came with an escort of a fighting patrol, which was all quickly assembled, and we shot off together. The Trevor Hart's medical base remained in the valley, and I went with Nutter and one other, and we retraced our steps up the feature. By then it was daylight, and we then came immediately under very heavy fire of both small arms, machine gun, and mortars. Not shelling, mortars. So we called down smoke onto 317, which is where you felt all the enemy observation was coming from. And I felt it was, you know, better to cut the numbers, to go really far forward. So I left Nutter and his radio halfway up the feature by himself, and another soldier and I went forward. We crawled a long way up and got back to where we were, because one could see the cartridge cases and so on. And the enemy trench was ahead of us, but they weren't shooting at us from it. It was as though they'd gone to bed. But we were being heavily fired at, and we'd been seen from the left. All the firing, other than from the trench, seemed to come from the left, none of it from the right. We stayed there, calling down smoke. The smoke gave us a great moral comfort, although I think the enemy continued to fire on fixed lines. When the smoke was down, we could get up and walk. We felt we could get up and walk around. So the two of us walked around the area short of the trenches, I would think up to 50 yards. There was clearly nothing. There were, you know, one would find a rifle, one would find a weapon, one would find evidence of a battle having taken place. But I was absolutely convinced there were no casualties lying between us and the enemy trench. None at all. It was open scrub. There were not bushes there at all. It was war-torn countryside, rocky, scrubby, but very clearly there was nothing. And so the decision, well, there was nothing more we could do. So I radioed this, got back to Jinder Nutter, who was very pleased to see us because he was all by himself. And he got into a shell hole and was feeling quite safe but very lonely. And we told them that there were no survivors. I didn't recommend an attack on the trench. It was I thought it would be, I don't know, not sensible. I said, but I will wait in this area for about, what do you think, an hour? We said, okay, stay for an hour, to see if anybody came out. Suddenly, then, the whole area received a tremendous amount of shelling, of both shells and mortar, and unfortunately, I knew that the regimental medical base had been hit, and I know that one soldier was killed. The fire was very intense, but it was very erratic and just searching. The smoke was coming down. The casualty from the medical base was evacuated. They halved the numbers of people at the medical base, moved their position slightly, and then just waited. I and the radio operator remained up there for an hour or so. And we were still receiving mortar fire, we were still receiving light machine gun fire in the general area, but no accuracy, but worryingly enough. I then decided to withdraw, came back to the medical team, who were very concerned about us. We were all very tired, and particularly Jinder Nutter carrying this 31 set, which is very heavy, and went back and reported and discussed the event. By then one was pretty tired, because I think I'd been out about, I don't know, 18 hours or so, something like that, 15 hours and 18 hours. We got back, but I know that Jonathan was not there. I think Corporal Guess was not there. They were both deemed either captured or dead. Or wounded, but not clearly not on the surface of the ground. And so we then got back, cleaned ourselves and our weapons and so on, recovered ourselves, and then slept. It was a very awesome experience. Clearly the enemy were better prepared than we were, I think. They had extremely good defensive positions, and but no wire. You see, we had barbed wire, they didn't. But I think they had forward defensive positions with so many soldiers, all with automatic weapons, it seemed, and grenades. but I don't think they had a chance, the fighting patrol.
Now, you were awarded the MC, an immediate MC for that.
Yes, I was. I was very honoured, delighted that Ginger Nutter got a mention, but I was awarded an immediate military cross, which I was, you know, sorrowful about Wormhold and Guest and so on. Felt to this day that I could have done better. I really do. I still think about it. Of course, writing to his parents, they were distraught, of course, and desperately sought, you know, was he a prisoner? Was he alive? Was he wounded? Was he dead? They tried everything in their power to find out this information, but there was no information at all until, I think, one day Corporal Guest came through Panmunjom after the armistice, or the armistice, the ceasefire was agreed. I received the military cross. I received the ribbon from the general commanding the Commonwealth Division. And then after Hong Kong, I was invited to Buckingham Palace, and the Queen awarded me the military cross. A very sobering and a very honouring occasion. But I still worry about whether I could have done more. And still to this day, and some nights, even now, 50 years later, why couldn't we find them? Should we have stupidly charged the trenches? And the answer was no. I mean, it would have been ridiculous. We would have all been wiped out. And it wasn't what leadership is supposed to do. It's supposed to do the job, but not take ridiculous risks. Jonathan Wormhold, I think, was very brave, and his team were very brave, but I think they walked into a hail of fire. The supporting arms, the tanks, the gunners, the mortars, the smoke, was splendid. And the soldiers were just tremendous. They absolutely were. They were asked to do ridiculous things, risky things, and they did it without even a hesitation. An occasional humorous remark. Well, I can't see anything to shoot at. Well, it doesn't matter. Shoot. provided a little light lessening of the tension we all felt. I think we then went back to our line, our platoon positions, and the next day got on with events as they happened, as they normally happened. There was another serious patrol in front of me that involved my very dear friend, John Burney, who was my senior at Sandhurst by a term or two, a very dedicated soldier, a very dedicated Norfolkman, married. He married. I was his best man just before we sailed. It was in Salisbury, from Britain. It was in Salisbury Cathedral. A great party. And on this Hill 118.
Hang on, what was he like? Tell us a bit more. I mean, to give us a picture of him as a man, you know.
Tall, a very tall, distinguished-looking man. His father was Julian Burney Bart, who was Speaker of the House in Rhodesia, or either Governor of Rhodesia at the time. A very, very distinguished-looking person. Serious. A tall, 6'3" man, moustache, a very good soldier, excellent with his weapons. He and I went on the small arms course at Hythe together, and we did a lot together, and as I said, I was his best man. And we went out in the cabin on the all together. He was going to make the army his career, and he would have made, I think, a very high rank. We were very, very close friends indeed. And he supported me, I think, in my initial days and joining the regiment by helping me, telling me what to do. I remember him always saying, look busy. Whatever you're doing, look busy and always carry a millboard with you, because that will protect you from getting extra duties. And such a nice person. And wife, Davina, whom I saw just 2 years ago at the dedication of Norwich Cathedral, its 900th dedication, and the dedication of the Royal Norfolk Chapel in Norfolk Cathedral. Yes. I do remember that Davina, John's wife, was carrying their child, and he was very proud of this, hoping it would be a boy who would inherit the title. And so he had... his life was full of promise. He went on a fighting patrol, I think about August 1952.
Well, according to the thing, it looks like it was 24th of July, the 24th, 25th of July.
Right, right.
24th of July.
Yes, that sounds right. And he had to lead a fighting patrol on Hill 118, which was on the feature we codenamed Crete, and it looked like Crete in the Mediterranean. There was a listening patrol post there, and John Burney was leading it, and they were attacked by a superior force. This was just across from the feature to the south, just across from the feature that I've just been talking about, by about 100 yards. So the enemy at that time had pushed their boundaries a little further towards us. His patrol, and the action took place beneath me, and I could see it happening. I did not know it was Burney there at the time. And I talked to people who were members of the patrol, and they said that they were knocked off, attacked by a superior number, and there was hand-to-hand fighting. Eventually, John Burney ordered the patrol off the hill to the valley floor, where they regrouped. And he discovered that several of the men were missing. So typical John Burney went up the hill, this was at night, to find them. He walked into the enemy, he didn't find them. His body was found the next morning with his pistol in his hand. And I know that that's the way he would like to have died. His wife, then, I know, Davina, came out to Japan. We got over the terrible tragedy news. And she went back, and she had her child, who was immediately Sir Julian Burney, and I met him for the first time at this Norfolk commemoration, Norfolk Cathedral commemoration, just 2 years ago. It was a very, very, very meaningful reunion. But it was an aggressive area, 355. My brother officers at this sort of low level, lieutenant, second lieutenant, reported contact with the enemy almost on a consistent basis. And afterwards one learnt that the Chinese were desperately trying to improve their line or capture dominating features while the truce negotiations were going on at Panmunjom. And there would be a gap in the negotiations caused by some stupidly ridiculous incident or event or protocol, whereas there'd be then a violent attack somewhere along the line with the Chinese attempting to secure significant features and then hold that and draw that as the as it would be the peace line. There were other patrol actions throughout that period, but it was almost our swan song in the line. We'd had a lot of bloody activity. We'd had our casualties. We'd done ourselves, I think, quite proudly. But it was time to go. And eventually, I think about, again, my memory of precise dates, but I think we were withdrawn from the line about September.
It seems they went in August back to new reserve positions, but right. I'm not sure where they were. It doesn't seem to say. And then they left in September.
Yes, and they were at a position further south where we had no more intercourse with the enemy. We were there for a restaging period of time. And then we moved back to Pusan by rail. I remember the significant event was a memorial service at the cemetery overlooking Pusan, where we had a very poignant memorial service with trumpeters, Last Post, Reveille, a firing party with honored shots, and I think a member of the British Embassy came in Seoul, came to wish us well and told us how well we'd done. And with that, we then boarded a ship for Hong Kong, which was just a few days, probably a week, sailing to Hong Kong. There, a new life awaited us, and it was a very interesting life, actually. We all got reassigned to new duties, new promotions. You know, the army system at that time, at the officer level, was you were promoted by time. You know, 2 years as a second lieutenant, I think 3 years as a lieutenant, and then you were a captain. And then you started to have to pass examinations before you increased your rank. We were all looking, we'd survived. That was the great moment. We were proud of what we'd done. We were happy to be there. And my goodness me, we were going to have a party when we got to Hong Kong.
What new duties were you put on to?
I was assigned to be in the support company in the machine gun platoon, which, as its second in command, from and the commander was a gentleman called Captain Alec Power. He and Sergeant Denny, as he was then, taught me all about machine gunning. Which was, I think, the elite of the... We thought so, anyway. And, of course, everybody thought they were the elite. But we thought we were the elite. The guns were complicated. We had carriers, 12 tracked carriers that we looked after. We had 6 Vickers machine guns firing great range, indirectly. A lot of mathematics involved. A lot of strategy and tactics as to laying down defensive fire tasks and trying to learn that even if your own position was being attacked, you didn't switch your machine gun round, machine gun away from its defensive fire task and fire at the enemy that were attacking you, as in the battles of old. And you trained. The delight was the support platoons, support company platoons, the mortars, the machine guns particularly, went and trained in very rough mountainous areas on the fringes of the new territories, where we had indirect shooting at night. We had machine gun competitions with other regiments in Hong Kong, and these were critical, of course, that you did well. Otherwise, the honour of the regiment... I remember on one occasion, Alec Parr and John Denny and I, after a night practice shoot, and we had huge white screens set up about, let's say, 3,000 yards away across a valley, way out in a place called Sri Krung, right through Hong Kong, through Kowloon, rather, right on the extremities of the new territories. And we fired away, we were terribly proud, all night at these targets, and went up to inspect them in the morning to find not a hole in the targets at all. And we discovered we'd had an error in our dial sights. So we perfected that sort of training, and we won the Machine Gun Cup for Hong Kong on numerous occasions. Then Alec power was...
Can I just ask you, did you actually learn to fire the machine gun yourself?
Oh, absolutely. And Eric Power, and I think the sergeants involved, we had more sergeants in the machine gun platoon than any other platoon in the battalion, because each detachment was commanded by a sergeant, and it was essential that all ranks learnt to fire the machine gun. And it requires a crew of three, and what you do, and the worst part, was carrying a 50-pound tripod, which you were often required for in action and in practice for competitions, to carry this 50-pound tripod for 100 yards probably, over obstacles, then set it up. And setting it up and getting it level and throwing the three legs out, clamping them down, getting it level, then calling the number two forward, who brought the gun itself, establishing the gun, getting the ammunition loaded, getting the boxes there, cocking it, which was complicated, and then the number one would raise the safety lever and with both thumbs, when ready to fire, press and the gun would fire. You had to tap, because it wasn't a precise weapon, you would tap every so often, you'd count. On the wooden handles, there were double handles, you'd tap once, and that would move the gun round, and almost accurately, and I don't know how it ever happened, each movement was 15 seconds round a 360-degree arc of movement, and you would do three to the left, and you would do three right to the right to bring you back to the centre of the target, and then you do three more to the right. So you covered a beaten zone, which was often about 150 yards long, depending on the range, and about 4 yards wide. And that was saturated with bullets. And you moved these cones of bullets around the area that you were harassing or neutralizing to the enemy. It was vital that all ranks learnt to fire, to maintain, to do the three duties, the number two, putting the weapon onto the tripod, putting the liners of ammunition. The ammunition was 250 rounds per container in a belt. Water cooled. You had to carry the water in a jerry can, assemble it. There were stories too of men having to pee into the containers, because if on sustained firing the water boils, and you can't. I know that John Denny in Korea changed barrels. Certainly on one patrol where he was supporting me, he changed I think 6 barrels in one night, and they ran out of water, and they had to do what comes naturally. And it does work. You had, in being involved in the machine gun platoon, you had to carry out repairs to the gun. There is a very complex mechanism called the lock, which is a studious piece of steel hardware with very strong springs, and you had to be able to take that apart and put it together blindfold. And the tactics and training of strategy and tactics of putting machine gun into the carrier, getting it somewhere, getting it unloaded, firing by night with the dial sight on the reverse slope of a hill was a science in itself. You leveled a bubble, you measured, you had to have a degree of common sense mathematics. It was a most reliable, a most efficient gun. And